Hello? That's too loud, isn't it?
I've just about had enough of you.
Affirmative, Day. I read you. I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do. This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Hello. And welcome to another episode of 50 Years of Shit Robots with Matt. Hello, and Stephen.
Hello.
I found something out this week, Stephen Murray.
Oh, here we go.
That I thought was really interesting. You know how on websites, when it says, "Are you a robot?" and it gets you to, you know, where are the fire hydrants? Where are the bikes? All that sort of stuff. It's called CAPTCHA, that. Do you know what CAPTCHA stands for? It's an acronym.
I've actually done a reel on this for our podcast.
So I completely ignored it.
It's on TikTok.
Oh, I wouldn't have seen that then. You're the TikTok boy, aren't you?
I've got two. I've got one from QI as well.
Oh, brilliant. Well, CAPTCHA, then you'll know this, stands for Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart. But I thought that was lovely. We've often spoken about the Turing test, and I thought it was fun to see it has an actual real life application.
Well, you know when it says, "Can you see any traffic lights in this?" and you click them, it's not particularly bothered about that, though that does come into it.
What's it bothered
what
about?
What it does is it tracks how you use your computer. So if your mouse is dithering around all over the place, it knows you're a human.
Next time I do it, if I just do it like super efficiently, very quickly.
Perfect straight line. Yeah. I would try to not use a mouse at all.
How would I do that?
Well, exactly. You're not a robot.
Good. Well, I'm glad you knew that. Well done, you. I mean, of all of the people in the world, I would have expected you to have known that. So, welcome. We are right in the middle of the deepest dive we've ever done into the film 2001, and we looked last week at the section of the film which is known as
The Dawn of Man.
Yeah, which is where all of the hominids go crackers when they see the monolith. I like to think that that is what that Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick would have written as their synopsis of that.
Monkeys go crackers. And I was thinking about that. I was thinking about why it was used in so many things. It's because it's universal. It is a universal thing. You don't have to know that it's from 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah, you mean why it's been sort of parodied so many times?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And by the way, we were talking about the fact that in the Barbie parody of it, that they used the original photographic plates. And I've looked back at them and they are identical.
Oh, wow.
So I think they did. I mean, basically, it is a sort of perfect shot-for-shot remake, the Barbie one.
That's amazing. Considering what Kubrick would throw in the skip.
Well, exactly. Something that we'll chat about, I think, in this section of the podcast. Because we're about to embark, like the character Floyd, we're going to go to the moon.
We're off to the moon.
In this bit. So you said last week that this is your favourite bit of the film.
Yeah, it is, and it isn't. It
why,
is
why
because
is it?
I love the effects in this, and I love the ingenuity behind the effects, because it's some of it is flawless, and some of it you think, wait a minute, and then you do a bit of research, you think, oh no, that's clever, how they did that. And then there is the sequences that I suggest that he's playing around with the idea that First Contact is going to be boring.
Yeah,
because the meeting is so dull.
Yeah, that's something that you said last week, wasn't it? And it's something that Stanley Kubrick had flagged up himself in a letter to Arthur C. Clarke. I should just say, if you haven't listened to it, then listen back to that first instance because it's good. But he said that one of the things he wanted to investigate when they started working together was the impact, and perhaps even lack of impact in some quarters, an extraterrestrial discovery would have on Earth in the near future.
Yeah.
And that sort of fits in with your philosophy of the film, doesn't it? That extraterrestrial-like contact is very boring.
It's going to be dull. It's going to be boring. It's going to be, no one's going to know. There's going to be a handful of people who's going to know, and we're going to deal with it. We're going to try and cope with it. and work it through. And I think that's going to be from both sides. It's going to be from the alien life forms and from us. I think it's there's not going to be a flying saucer land in the middle of Washington, D.C. with a 9-foot silver robot coming out.
No.
Which just feeds into conspiracy theories that they walk among us.
Yes. So this section of the film, the sort of moon section, goes from about 20 minutes to about 55 minutes in the film, if you want to keep track. And the sort of plot of this bit of the film is that there is a sort of quite senior manager called Floyd, who is traveling to, first of all, to a space station. And from that space station is then traveling onto the moon because a discovery has been made on the moon and he's going to check it out. And also in conjunction with that, a kind of like a cover story has been circulated. So the discovery is being kept secret from the general population. We get our first line of dialogue in this section of the film.
I got it.
25 minutes in.
I've got a little story about this because one of my students really, really wanted to watch the film and he downloaded it from somewhere and he was watching it. And then I got a message from him saying, it's 2001 Space Odyssey in French. And I went, no, why? He said, I finally got to a part where they're speaking and they're all speaking in French. And I went, you've downloaded a French version.
That's the answer.
Yeah. He persevered. He found a way of getting subtitles on.
That's good. But the reason why there's no dialogue for 25 minutes is, first of all, you've got the overture at the beginning. Then you've got the dawn of man, which is all hominids, so pre-language. Then you've got a sort of a five-minute section chronicling the trip that Floyd makes from Earth to the space station, which is all set to the Blue Danube. And then finally, you get the first line of dialogue.
Here you are, sir. Main level, please.
Right, it's the other way back.
And up to that point, it just looks so authentic. The only thing that doesn't is the Earth, because we didn't have any photographs of the full Earth. We didn't get that until about 1971.
Yeah, this was being filmed sort of 65, 66. When did Telstar go up? When was the first satellite?
That was in the early 60s.
Early 60s. So it's not long after that, is it?
No. We still weren't able to get far enough from the Earth with the technology to take a full photograph of the Earth.
And so I think that's really important to remember, particularly in this bit, that this is a time before the internet. It's a time before we had a photograph of the Earth. It's a time before we'd sort of set foot on the moon. All of those things hadn't happened yet. And yet you've got this incredible five-minute sequence sort of in you know, near Earth orbit space. And it just looks so good.
Yeah.
So we were saying last week that something that is slightly missing from the film 2001, that is sort of part of the DNA of the story, is that there are tons of nuclear warheads orbiting Earth. There was a bit of narration over this section, which completely explains it all. I discovered that there were lots of bits of dialogue and bits of narration that were just jettisoned by Kubrick. I think probably for the best. And I've got it. So it goes like this. So it would have said, by the year 2001, overpopulation has replaced the problem of starvation, but this was ominously offset by the absolute and utter perfection of the weapon. Then the stage direction is American 1,000 megaton bomb in orbit above Earth. Hundreds of giant bombs had been placed in perpetual orbit above the Earth. They were capable of incinerating the entire Earth's surface from an altitude of 100 miles. Matters were further complicated by the presence of 27 nations in the nuclear club. There had been no deliberate or accidental use of nuclear weapons since World War II, and some people felt secure in this knowledge. But to others, the situation seemed comparable to an airline with a perfect safety record. It showed admirable care and skill, but no one expected it to last forever.
No, you see, that's Tell. They could have easily shown that when the bone turns into the ship, which is a weapon, if it looked like a weapon.
Yeah.
You'd make that leap. You'd make that leap yourself. Yeah.
Or it had what's his face from Doctor Strangelove riding it,
sitting it on it.
Yeah. But you know what? I was thinking to myself that actually, what I like about this film, the more I watch it, is the mystery of it.
Yes, definitely.
And I think that it's not unimportant, that this idea that humans are, you know, just set for destruction, but it feels like it doesn't really matter that I don't know that. I don't think.
No, so much in the film though. There's so much that you've got to think about.
Got to think about things, ain't ya?
You've got to
use your blummin' noggin, ain't ya?
So. You've got a Jemmy and accent in.
So the models that are used for this, if you can picture this scene, they were, a lot of them were 2 foot long. They were that big so that cameras could get into them and it would still look, you know, real.
I think it was around about this time that they stopped using the word miniatures and started using bigatures.
All of the models were, or sorry, most of the models after the film were destroyed at the behest of Stanley Kubrick.
Because he didn't want any movies to use his models.
No.
They did find part of the space station.
The wagon wheel one.
Yeah. It was in a playground.
Brilliant.
That just goes to show you how robust it was. It did survive. It was only half of it.
There was one that was kept, or it was donated to a teacher who used it to teach things and then sold it quite recently for about $350,000. So that's nice, isn't it?
Well, these models were amazing. And this was kind of, have you ever heard of kit bashing?
No.
Kit bashing is a way of making other models from the kits of other models. And so it's always been done in the model world. But when it comes to special effects, kit bashing came in for miniature detail. So they'd take anything from any of the model kits, Airfix kits, even the little armatures that held all the pieces together, and they'd be used in the creation of these models. 2001 was a pioneer in kit bashing. And then that went on. Well, there's a plethora of people who worked on the special effects in this, but they all became experts in kit bashing, and they all worked on Star Wars. And if you look at the docking of the Pan Am spaceship onto the space station, it looks exactly like the entrance to the Death Star.
Yes, it does. You're absolutely right. It really does look like a bit of Star Wars action, that, doesn't it? So we've got this beautiful sort of like long sequence with the Pan Am shuttle that's carrying Floyd to the wagon wheel space station, traveling through space, docking, and it does all look incredible, doesn't it?
It's interesting when he is on the Pan Am airplane that there are televisions in the backs of the seats.
Yes.
That was not a thing. He envisaged that.
Yeah.
And then the pen.
He's asleep on the Pan Am.
And he's the only person on the plane.
Yeah. And there's a floating pen, which is just a really lovely effect.
And are you going to tell them how he did it? Because I asked my students, and I have not once in 15 years of doing this lecture, not one student has guessed.
Well, I wouldn't have been able to guess, I don't think, but I do know that it was on a sheet of glass.
Yeah. I know he probably is taking his skills from the Dawn of Man sequences and not getting shadows of the front projection. There is not one reflection on that piece of glass.
That's Kubrick.
And you cannot see the double-sided sellotape. It's not double-sided sellotape because I researched double-sided sellotape, and that doesn't really come along until about 1978.
Right.
Even the slight force that she has to do is nothing, and it's just perfect.
Yeah, it is.
She was probably made to do it 285 times.
Yeah. Her name is Heather Downham. She was one of the space hostesses, and she had a couple of really interesting stories. The first is that she had a really bad back when she was filming this sequence. And I don't know if you can bring it to mind, but she's walking down the sort of like the aisle, and she's got grip shoes on, and then she staggers. And that was just because she was in pain because of her bad back. But she said as soon as she did it, Kubrick was like, "That's brilliant. I love it." Because it does look, it's so natural to see that now when you're on a plane. Yeah. That sort of slight lurch because, you know, you're slightly off balance. But I thought that was brilliant. But she said that all of the space hostesses would have to meet Stanley Kubrick every morning before they went. But before they met him, an assistant would come and say, "Mr. Kubrick would like your thoughts for the day." And so she said, she just kept, because she was really sort of feisty. She said, "I would say things like," and this is a quote from her, "I now see immortality as the fate of all of us."
Oh, wow.
And Stanley Kubrick, when he heard that, would say, "Good, we can go with that. Now let's get to work."
So he's been getting all of his ideas for films from air hostesses. we've cracked him.
Yeah, I thought that was excellent. But I mean, and the outfits that they use, that they have as well, are so good, aren't they? Those enormous. Oh, they're brilliant. I mean, maybe we could just chat a little bit about one of the key designers of the costumes, Hardy Amis.
Really? Was it Hardy Amis?
Yeah. Who? I mean, I knew you'd know him because he was most famous for designing lots of outfits for the other space alien, Her Majesty Elizabeth II.
Yes, he is the one of the bright coloured bonnets and the acid-coloured coats.
Apparently Kubrick said to him, you know, these have got to look different and futuristic, but not like sort of way out there. They've got to be sort of grounded in reality. And so one of the things he did on the suits of the men was didn't have any buttons.
Do you know, I think, thinking about that now after you've told me that, I think it's an absolute genius idea to get Hardy Amis to do it, as opposed to Paco Rabanne in Barbarella.
Yeah.
Because Paco Rabanne was experimenting with ridiculous materials, thinking about the future. And it always will look it'll always look 60s. To get Hardy Amis to do it, who's an established haute couture designer, is genius.
It's good, isn't it?
I'm even more impressed.
I was looking at Hardy Amis and his life. It's really interesting because he, during the war, was, because he spoke a few different languages, he was asked to serve in the Special Operations Executive, or the SOE. He sounds like a bit of a character in the army. One of his commanding officers, Major General Colin Gubbins, apparently did not regard a dressmaker as suitable military material. His training reports had stated, "This officer is far tougher both physically and mentally than his rather precious appearance would suggest. Oh, he possesses a keen brain and an abundance of shrewd sense. His only handicap is his precious appearance and manner, and these are tending to decrease." He was posted to Belgium. He worked with various resistance groups and supposedly adapted names of fashion accessories for use as code words.
Of course he would.
And went around sabotaging things. He was knighted in Belgium and was made an officer of the Order of the Crown in 1948 by the Prince Regent of Belgium. It says that he was an integral part of Operation Rat Week, which was an assassination project developed by SOE to eliminate double agents and Nazi sympathisers. A BBC Two documentary in the year 2000 entitled Secret Agent named Amis as one of the men who helped to plan the killing of dozens of Nazi collaborators. Amis disclaimed all knowledge of the matter, though.
He would have to.
Yeah, but isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah, it is.
And then he went on to become, like, as you say, like Savile Row stalwart and...
Yep.
Part of the establishment, designed the sort of like the leisure wear outfits for the England 1966 World Cup winning squad, designed for Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth.
Yes. I love that. I think that is amazing. And it's just another feather in Kubrick's cap. And his cap is full of feathers.
It's got so many feathers in it.
It could take
it's more
off.
More feathers than hat.
It is.
Good morning, sir.
Morning.
We haven't seen you up here for a long time.
No, very nice to see you again.
Did you have a pleasant flight, sir?
That's very nice, thanks. I think Mr. Miller of Station Security is supposed to be meeting me.
Now we're in the space station, the wagon wheel space station. One of the things I like about this whole section is that it's basically, it feels like Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke showing off what they think the future will be like. Because there's loads of stuff, isn't there? There's like the video, the voice recognition system that Floyd has to... yeah. sort of navigate to get in.
So he can get onto the station.
Yeah. I mean, the only difference to it now is that the voice activation interface is like a chirpy woman in a lovely cloth cap on a video screen.
Designed by Hardy Amos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's that. There's the Skype telephone that Floyd contacts his daughter on.
And that's one of Kubrick's daughters.
That's one of Kubrick's daughters, yeah. Yeah. And that's and such again, a fun little scene as well. That.
It is a fun little scene, but it also shows kind of the mundanity of it.
Yeah.
So he's talking to his daughter, talking about what she wants for her birthday.
Yeah.
While the earth is nauseously spinning out the window.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you, Squirt?
Hello.
What are you doing?
Playing.
Where's Mummy?
Going to shopping.
Oh, who's taking care of you?
Rachel.
May I speak to Rachel, please?
She's going to the bathroom. Are you coming to my party tomorrow?
I'm sorry, sweetheart, but I can't.
Why not?
Well, you know, Daddy's traveling. Very sorry about it, but I just can't.
And the call costs $1.70.
They got that wrong, didn't they?
From the moon. Sorry, from halfway to the moon.
Yeah, exactly. We also, in this sequence, we get, again, a conversation between Floyd and some Russian scientists, headed by Leonard Rossiter. Oh,
I could see that wry smile on your face.
He's great, though, isn't he?
He is great, actually, yeah.
Yeah, he's really good. I couldn't find any... I was really trying to find where Kubrick had met Leonard Rossiter, like why Leonard Rossiter. Because by all accounts, they really hit it off.
He's a good actor. I mean, this is the, really we always think actor. Of him as a comedian and his comic parts, which are brilliant. But by all accounts, Leonard Rossiter was a really excellent actor and really great to work with.
Yeah. But that scene is interesting because Leonard Rossiter has heard the cover story that has been circulated about a sort of contagious outbreak on the moon. And he wants to know what the reason is, but Floyd won't tell him. He says, "I'm sorry, I'm not at liberty to discuss that."
It's very uncomfortable, that scene.
Yeah, it is,
and
isn't it?
I think it's very cleverly directed because it starts off and you think he's just going to come up with an excuse and stick with it, but then he just goes quiet.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, we have had some very reliable intelligence reports that quite a serious epidemic has broken out at Cleves. Something apparently of an unknown origin. This is, in fact, what has happened.
Sorry, Dr. Smyslov, but I'm really not at liberty to discuss this.
I understand. But this epidemic could quite easily spread to our base. We should be given all the facts, Dr. Floyd.
Yes, I know. As I said, I'm not at liberty to discuss it.
The hotel that's there is the Hilton.
Yeah.
And the restaurant is the Howard Johnson's restaurant, which was a real chain.
Oh, right.
And to celebrate, they produced a comic of 2001 A Space Odyssey for the children in the restaurant. And I've seen a copies of it, and it's amazing.
Mm.
It's a really cracking comic.
Oh, that's good. Like sort of Pizza Express style, but you know, where you get something for the kids, don't you?
Yeah.
They can read. So Floyd, after chatting to Leonard Rossiter, jumps on another shuttle, and he's off. He's off to the moon.
You haven't done your Leonard Rossiter impression.
No, I can't. I'm not going to treat everyone to that. There are. If you want to hear the Leonard Rossiter, you'll have to go back to listen to the Arthur C. Clarke episode.
You've done it. I've done you it. Don't I've boil your it. Cabbage twice.
Exactly. So there's some really nice things that happen on this. Again, it's another completely wordless, dialogueless trip to the moon on this shuttle. We get some very strange food that he eats, which is like pouches that he has to suck, that Floyd has to suck. But I thought this was the one really rubbish bit of the future, as portrayed by Kubrick.
Is really?
Well, because the food you'd have thought, I mean, the food would be like a liquidized version of chicken tikka masala or something, wouldn't it? Or steak and chips. But actually, you've just got a pouch of carrots, a pouch of corn, a pouch of... It's like the individual foods You think, oh, that would be horrible.
Are you expecting a prawn cocktail and a steak Diane from the 1960s?
Yes, that's exactly what I'd want. But, I mean, Willy Wonka knew, didn't he? he knew that the chewing gum would have the flavour of tomato soup. And it would have the flavour of meals rather than the individual constituents, I suppose.
All the food on the Pan Am flight has been supplied by Willy Wonka Incorporated.
You've got a lovely bit of special effect work with a hostess who walks up a wall in order to access another bit of the ship, which is, again, it's another practical effect, which is so beautiful, isn't it?
It's so gorgeous. Yeah. You've got to understand, though, this had already been done before, and mainly in a Fred Astaire film.
Okay.
Where he dances, he does this whole dance sequence, and he dances on the floor, then on the wall, and then on the ceiling, and then goes back round again. It's exactly the same technique. And there's a corridor sequence that is very much an homage from Inception.
So this was done where the whole set would revolve.
Yeah, and the camera was fixed. The
camera was fixed, and the actor who's walking is walking on a treadmill.
So she walks around with her grip shoes, and she goes completely upside down and then walks through a door. And then she appears in the doorway upside down, the camera turns around. It's amazing.
You've got that lovely special effect. It's so nice. And also you've got, is it the one joke in this?
Yeah, the zero gravity toilet.
Yeah. So there's like a number of points that you've got to follow before you can use the toilet. Point four, you may leave the lavatory if the green exit light is on over the door. If the red light is illuminated, one of the lavatory facilities is not properly secured. Press the stewardess call button to the right of the door. She will secure all facilities from her control panel outside. When green exit light goes on, you may open the door and leave. Please close the door behind you. There's just a lot of that going on.
It's quite interesting that the International Space Station, when new people arrive, it has a smell.
Does it?
Yeah, because of the toilet system.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And the smell is of human feces.
Just humanness.
Humanity.
Just the smell of humanity.
So as the shuttle approaches the moon, you've got this really beautiful, sort of quite lengthy landing sequence, haven't you, with the pod that they're in?
Yeah, and I love that.
So lovely.
I love the rebound when it lands. And then it's like this thing, that's not the end of it. Because then it goes underground.
And those sets are real and they're massive. I mean, the pod is only sort of like 2 feet high, but that whole set where it descends into the earth is like.
And then in the walls, there's like cavities, and then in the cavities, you can see people moving.
I know, it's
beautiful. Sometimes they're upside down.
Oh, it's just so good. Oh. Yeah, it's so good. I mean, in many ways, because again, it's quite lengthy. There's not many cuts in this sequence mainly because it feels like it's driven by the music. And maybe he thought to himself, do you know what? I'm glad I'm letting the music lead this, because it'll give people a chance to see all of the hard work.
Well, yeah.
That's gone into like filming those.
And the gorgeous screens and the actual graphic user interface. They look beautiful. You almost don't notice them because they function. All of the screens are square and everything about them is they're flat and they're matte. And you just think, oh God, yeah, they are so futuristic. Even now, I look at them and think, oh, that is spot on.
The shuttle lands, and then we're straight into this meeting. And this is the boring meeting that you... that you spoke about, but there's actually a really brilliant story about this that I found that from this book I've read.
Oh my God!
Which is, it's called Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, R.C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. It's by Michael Benson. If you're interested at all in this, then I recommend it because it is really good.
How much of that have you read?
I've just been reading bits and bobs.
I mean, I know this is a podcast, but he's just held up this book and it's big enough to stun an ox.
It's so massive. But I just want to just find the bit about, oh, is this it?
Yes. I've increasingly realised that you are becoming more and more of an expert than I am.
Do you know what? This film, the more I've watched it and delved into it, the more I like it. I mean, I always really liked it, but I'd say it might be one of my like top three favourite films of all time now.
It's in my top 10, and there's only 7 in my top 10, as I have said before.
Exactly. So this little story like feeds into this idea of Kubrick being a monster in terms of like the number of takes that he does as well. So far, there's not been much dialogue, really, has there? And this sequence, which is this sort of meeting that Floyd goes to, Floyd's got a monologue which was about 280 words, which was broken into 19 uninterrupted sentences, after which he's asked a question, and then he had another 100 or so words. So about 400 words in total that he's got. But one thing that when you see this scene, I think it's such an interesting looking scene. So you've got like a sort of wide shot of the room and everyone in the room. And this shot just holds. There's no close-ups. There's no cutaways or anything that you might sort of expect for ages and ages and ages and ages.
Your interest is kept, though, because there's a photographer. And the photographer is placed in a particular part of the screen, which makes, if it was a still image, it would make it balanced.
Absolutely.
So the photographer is there and he's taken these photographs.
Yeah.
And then he leaves through these weird double doors that I never ever noticed before until I watched it the other night.
Yeah.
And then Floyd makes a strange obelisk shape with his hand. Because you don't hear anything. You just hear background chit-chat. And he makes this obelisk thing with his hand. And then the guy who's overseeing the meeting stands up and speaks.
Yeah, and sort of introduces Floyd. Yeah. The effect I got from this, just this one shot, is that it's almost like you are part of the meeting. Like you're sort of in a row of chairs behind. But I mean, I don't know if that was the intention.
No, that fits. Yeah, that fits.
But in the sort of timeline of filming, a couple of days before this sequence was filmed, the character Floyd had been involved in another bit of filming, which is the conversation that it takes place still in this section, but a bit further on, where there's three men, they're travelling towards the monolith and they're eating sandwiches and they're having coffee. Do you remember that scene? Yeah.
Oh, God, completely, because this holds up my theory.
Right, exactly, of it being really boring. Yeah. But that scene took days to film because one of the actors just kept flubbing their lines, and apparently...
What lines?
Yeah, exactly. And apparently Kubrick was sort of like furious, but internalized it. Didn't want the actors to know that he was so furious. And so anyway, so you get to this section that is being filmed a few days later, this meeting, and Stanley Kubrick says, like, as they turn up for work, he says, right, I'm going to shoot this just in one shot, okay? So you've just got to do it. And the guy who plays Floyd just virtually had a nervous breakdown. Couldn't do it. So the intention was always for it to be one shot, but actually in the film it isn't. He does go to a close up of Floyd and a reverse shot of someone asking the question, and that is because the actor just could not do it. It's hardly surprising. Like, one of his first sentences is the following: "It should not be difficult for any of you to realize the extremely grave potential
for cultural shock and social disorientation contained in this present situation. If the facts were prematurely and suddenly made public without adequate preparation
and conditioning." Oh my god! I mean, that's just like, it's such an odd sentence, isn't it?
So, how many takes did it take?
This is a quote from this book I've got. Says he blew the phrase over and over, with the number of takes growing to a total of 21, only 5 of which were deemed good enough to print. The last 9 consisted an uninterrupted building humiliation of unprinted flubs and let's try it agains and turnovers, until Sylvester, that's the actor, who'd started visibly trembling and was bathed in flop sweat, said finally, "I can't do it anymore, I've had it," and was helped from the podium by one of the nurses always on call and taken away.
Oh, I've heard that there was always nurses there. And 21 takes is nothing for Stanley Kubrick.
No, but I mean, it's sort of like you often think that it's him being like so meticulous, but actually in this instance, it's because he wanted to do it in one take and the actor just wasn't up to it. Then the next day after this, Stanley Kubrick was chatting to Roger Carras. So this guy who'd been involved in lots of his productions before, and he'd also been Joan Crawford's press secretary. so had experience of dealing with problematic actors. And so Kubrick was beside himself, remembered Karras. He vented about how many takes he'd just blown and said he never did get the scene, which was easy enough to do. Well, do what you have to do. I don't want to ever have a day like that again. Don't tell me what you have to do. And so what Karras did was he confronted the actor and said, I want you to come to a press conference this afternoon because the press conference is going to be telling the world that you are fired from this film. The actor in question stared disbelieving for a moment and then burst into tears. After a wordless pause punctuated by sobbing, Karras extracted a promise concerning the rest of the shoot, which was kept, he remembered. I made no such statement. There was no press conference, but I scared him to death. From then on, the man knew his lines.
And we don't know who that was.
I'm assuming it's the actor playing Floyd, but I can't.
Oh, really?
I can't be certain.
Wow.
Thank you, Dr. Floyd.
Thank you.
To have this idea that everything is very boring and very sort of corporate, I suppose, isn't it? It's or organisational.
Yeah, it's got to the point where they're not even excited about it. It's like, you'd think there'd be a buzz, but there isn't.
No.
And it's like, you know, they found this anomaly, this Tycho magnetic anomaly on the moon, and it's like, they're talking about it over some sandwiches.
Yeah, I know. I know. It is. It's so fascinating. But I think you're absolutely right. Your theory is absolutely right about this idea that he wanted to bake into this extraterrestrial contact. And how boring the reality of it would be.
I think it's a way of making a film, if you're making a film, as in producing a film, making it interesting for yourself. I think if he is really playing around with that idea, I think he'll still be invested in it, because we've already established that he wasn't particularly interested in making a science fiction film.
Yeah.
And I think he's definitely put his own twist on it, his own thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because one of the things in the meeting, one of the phrases that Floyd says is that this discovery on the moon, we're not sure what it is yet, quotes, is the most significant in the history of science. And he even says that.
Yeah.
So, you know. And yet,
there isn't even a sharp intake of breath, is there?
No, it's me treated with such boredom. Once the meeting is over, we're into another little scene that has lots of dialogue. And which is mainly very boring.
But the jarring of that scene, you go from that meeting room, which is almost monochrome, and then you go into this two-split colour scene of really vibrant blue and then this red, this blood red of the cockpit.
Yes.
And then again, you've got that, which is like amazing. And then you see these shots of the shuttle silently, and this is another thing that Kubrick was not tempted to do, put any kind of spaceship sounds in, because there wouldn't be any. This gorgeous scene of this tiny ship silently travelling across the lunar landscape. And it's all sort of eye-popping and wonderful. And then they just have the dullest conversation on the planet.
Yes, they do.
Sorry, on the moon.
There's a great bit of scene setting that is in the script, the original script for this scene, which says, a few seats away, Michaels and Halverson carry out a banal administrative conversation in low tones. It should revolve around something utterly irrelevant to the present circumstances and very much like the kind of discussion one hears all the time in other organisations.
I love it.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
And again, we get, in this sequence, we get some more of the Ligeti music, which is this weird, like, vocal, kind of choral, dissonant music, isn't it?
They didn't ask him if they could use the music. And they actually changed a little bit of the music as well, which Ligeti was irate about. And they settled out of court.
Oh, right. Yeah. How did they change it?
They cut it and they put some reverb on. They kind of electronically changed it. some little bits, especially I think it was during the Stargate sequence. I would be absolutely delighted if I was that composer.
Yeah.
For God's sake.
Exactly.
Shut your mouth.
The person who suggested to Stanley that he use that music was his wife.
She'd
heard it on the radio and knew that he was in the market for some strange music.
There was some Mahler that was being used that sounded very similar but doesn't sound as unearthly as
right.
that.
So in this sequence, we sort of find out the most detail about what the anomaly is that they've discovered on the moon. And it's called, as you said, a Tycho Magnetic Anomaly, the Tycho Magnetic Anomaly 1, which is the monolith. We know that it has been buried 4 million years ago. We're pretty sure in this sequence that it's extraterrestrials who've done it.
Yeah.
From this shuttle sequence where they just eat sandwiches and have boring conversations, we then get to go to the monolith site, the sort of excavation site, which again looks so so beautiful. And apparently had to be shot at Shepperton. Wasn't shot at Borehamwood because it was just too big. It's such a massive set.
Because it's on two levels, isn't it?
Yeah.
With a ramp down to the anomaly.
That's right.
To the monolith.
Yeah. So it is. They've had to excavate the monolith, which again is all part of the aliens' plan, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've got to
it have... It kind of harks back to the Sentinel.
Yeah,
if we've got the ability to get to the moon, then we're on our way to leaving the solar system.
Yeah.
And so becoming a nuisance.
An absolute ruddy pain in the ass to all concerned. So this is the final sort of sequence of this moon section of the film where a few sort of scientists all suited up in spacesuits clamber down the ramp towards the monolith. This shot, or this sequence was the very first thing that was shot from the film. Like day one of shooting, and actually there's a handheld shot that follows the scientists down the ramp, and that was shot by Stanley Kubrick himself. By all accounts, there was a frisson of excitement as he strapped a camera to his back.
He does like to be a bit hands-on every now and again. He's only ever appeared in one of his films.
Which one was that one?
Eyes Wide Shut.
What does he appear as?
He's just in a restaurant in the background.
Oh, right.
I think he's with his wife.
Oh, very interesting. Mm. So the scientists descend down the ramp towards the monolith, and they're all sort of like Floyd goes and touches the monolith, and there's a photographer there, and they're about to have one of those sort of corporate photographs.
I love that because he's getting them to get together so he can get the whole of the monolith in.
Yeah.
And again, that's just this mundane, everyday thing.
Yeah.
And he's taking photographs.
And then there is a huge squealing sound that they have to put their hands up to their ears, but their helmets are in the way. They can't stop the noise. And then there's a shot of the sun rising over the monolith and with the earth in it. And then it cuts and we've finished the moon sequence. There's a cut bit of dialogue from this section. There was going to be some dialogue. I think it would have been done via the intercoms, you know, through the helmet. And it would have revealed that because of when the monolith was excavated, that this is the very first sunlight that the monolith has seen in 4 million years.
I kind of got that.
I think that supposedly is the trigger, because this sound is sort of like an alarm system or something that the aliens have set, isn't it? So it's maybe the sunlight that has triggered the alarm rather than the touching.
Quite a few people thought that they all died, but they don't, because Floyd reappears in 2010, the year we make contact.
Well, he also is in this film again.
Is he? Oh, he is. He is.
So in the timeline of this film, we're not sure at the moment what's happened to these scientists. We just cut and we're like 2 years later, 18 months later or something.
Yeah.
So there we are. That is your favourite bit of 2001.
I think, do like the effects in that. I like the colour grading. I like the cuts. I like the idea that he's playing around with a lovely idea that's keeping him interested in the film as well.
Yeah. It's nice, isn't it? It's that twin thing which works so brilliantly of sort of marveling at the alien contact or the mystery of what this monolith is. We know it was planted there 4 million years ago by something, some civilization. But also working with that and against that is this idea, as you say, of it being utterly mundane, utterly boring. Yeah. Okay, well, that's it. We're going to end it there, not least because we have now, I think, our podcasts on 2001, and we're not even at the halfway stage of the film, now total more than the total running time of the film itself.
Oh, wow, does it?
I think so.
I think you've always wanted to do that, though, haven't you?
Yeah, we're absolutely smashing this. It's brilliant. I love it. And there's still so much more to discuss. I mean, I'm slightly worried that this is too much.
Do you think so?
I don't know. I don't know what people will think when they listen to this, whether it's just too much information, too boring. I mean, maybe like Kubrick himself, the discussion of this amazing film is rooted in utter boredom. Utter boredom. Right, so gird your loins for the next episode when we will be flying to Jupiter. And we're going to meet someone who seems nice at first and then turns out to be very, very bad. We're going to be meeting Hal.
I still liked him. After.
I still loved him. I could have changed him. I could have changed him.
Come on, Al.
He's not worth it, Al. Leave him. He's not worth it. Right. So until next week, goodbye.
Goodbye.
And, of course, his congratulations on your discovery, which may well prove to be among the most significant in the history of science.